Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Yes, boys and girls, we welcome into the studio the man who has been a part of our show for really more than a quarter of a century. Yes. on various radio stations.
Oh.
Chicago's own ghost hunter, Richard Crowe.
Can you believe Richard?
Happy Halloween, guys.
Happy Halloween. Halloween.
More than a quarter of a century. We sat here and said, okay, well, I knew you before I knew Steve.
Right.
And both Johnny and I had you on the air over at another radio station, and we've been here for
24 years,
so... Well, let's back up. For people who are new to Richard Crowe, who is Chicago's ghost hunter, and you will find a link to his website on our blog After Dark. But let's go back to the beginning of a baby ghost hunter and how you became Chicago's ghost hunter.
Well, there's two sides to that. There's the fact that I was very interested in ghost stories from a young age, and was always trying to... like on family vacation, get my dad to drive out of the way to stop at that Indian burial ground or this strange location or whatever. So there's that side of it. But then the commercial application actually came about during my college days. And that's when I was at DePaul University, and my geography professor, Dr. Richard Hauck, would ask me to put together a tour of the ghostly geography around Chicago because of my reputation at the campus. And I was the guy that you went to for ghost stories. So that tour was back in 1973. Now, if any of our listeners can remember the 70s, and they say that if you're around in the 70s, you don't remember them.
Yeah.
But if you can remember the 70s, we had everything from psychic fairs.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mood rings. Mm-hmm. We had pet rocks. We had Carillion photography. Put your hand in the black bag and photograph your aura.
That was a fun time.
Right. And then we also had, do you remember Ted Sirios on the north side of Chicago?
I remember the name.
Right. Yeah. We had him down at the other station with Eddie. And he was an elevator operator, Greek-American elevator operator. He would get drunk on scotch. He only drank the good stuff.
Yeah.
He pointed a Polaroid camera at his head and photographed his thoughts.
Yes.
Thoughtography.
Yes.
Dr. Jewel Eisenbud from the University of Colorado actually did a whole book on Ted.
Yes.
So that kind of stuff was going on. But no one had ever thought of a tour by bus of haunted places before.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came up with one, and boy, it just snowballed. And so that's how it all started.
That means Richard is the first and the original full-time. I mean, this is what you've done with your life. This was your calling, and you realized it back in the early 70s, so you're celebrating your 35th year.
35 years this year for the first tour rolling out from DePaul University campus on the 27th of October was the actual day.
Well, I didn't realize that this was going to be your 35th anniversary gift, but I feel that I must give you this gift, Richard. I present you with this.
Uh-huh.
It's a writing pen. You think it's got a little feather on the top of it, a little piece of a white boa, but in fact it's a ghost. And Richard, just take that pen top off and then press your pen down on that piece of paper. Take the bottom pen top off,
right.
Press
yeah.
that pen down on your piece of paper, and you will see your
Whoa.
Ghost.
Oh,
<lights up. laughs>
Oh, it's an orange ghost.
I think every ghost hunter should have his
That's wild.
Own lighted ghost pen.
Thank you so much. I'm going to play with this, yes.
Now, we should mention, too, that in addition to doing his ghost tours, Richard has appeared on any of a number of TV specials. He's
right.
Written a book on some of the hauntings that he has discovered. And that's been one of the fascinating things and one of the many reasons that we've had you back year after year. This is more than just taking people on tours. You've actually had some scary appearances or some scary incidents happen over
there. Scary is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
It's sort of like an affirmation here that you're doing the right thing when something does happen, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, it's scary to us. To Richard, it's bring it on. Bring it on, ghost. Richard's book is The Chicago Street Guide to the Supernatural. Just noticed it out in I think we were in Borders over the weekend.
Yeah, it's just being reprinted mm-hmm. again right now, so, yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So it's readily available, and the beauty of these stories is they don't get outdated. I mean, we're talking history. It's there for you. Great pictures, and it is indeed a guide, but you haven't lived until you've actually gone on one of Richard's ghost tours. This is your busy time of the year. We're lucky to get you in here.
So, right. Well, I did already work today. This is not work. This is play tonight. But I was at the, I want to give a shout out to my friends at the Ridge Historical Society at Beverly. And I spoke in a cemetery tonight, Mount Greenwood Cemetery, in their chapel.
Wow. So, now, that's a beautiful cemetery,
that's
too.
That's a great old cemetery, mm-hmm. yes.
So, if you would like Richard to come speak to your group, you're wide open.
In a cemetery or wherever,
yes. In a restaurant, in a haunted bar.
But where is the strangest place you've ever given one of your talks?
Hmm. Now, that's a good one. I always talk about the strangest people I've ever had.
Right.
Like a bus full of clowns who belong to a clown alley. And
that's terrifying.
A bus full of magicians who are all doing magic tricks.
Uh-huh.
Maybe the Star Trek convention when they all came out wearing Spock ears.
Uh-huh.
But the strangest place. That's a tough one, Steve. Perhaps it would be at the cemetery tonight. Now, in fact, I've spoken here before, too, so it's... Mm-hmm. That's a real nice venue there, and they're really very very open to this at the Mount Greenwood Cemetery.
Have there ever been, in the years that you've been giving these talks, have you ever been in the middle of a talk and something really strange happened?
Well, I just spoke recently, in fact, now that you bring it up, at Morton College in Cicero, and I've been out there many times over the years, and I don't know if you're aware of that, that's where Emily Kasich, who was a student of Morton College, but before they built the current campus, when they were holding classes at Morton East High School, where her body was found after she was murdered years ago. And then they would eventually build the campus on the spot where her body was found. And she's like the longest undergraduate student there because she's been there a long time. Now, she didn't act up the other night, but that's because when I start my lectures when I'm at Morton, I always acknowledge Emily and ask her for her cooperation so that she won't interfere. But it's well known at Morton College how in the theater, there's always going to be some kind of problems with anything from electricity to something going wrong with the lights, whatever. But it's usually until they acknowledge Emily and then things go back to normal again.
Wow.
Is this over 100 years ago that Emily was there? Or?
No, that was in the 70s.
It was the 70s?
Right. And the campus is a beautiful campus out there in Cicero.
Yeah.
And you've probably seen it if you're... You can go by in the Stevenson. You can almost see it from the Stevenson. So,
yeah. Wow. That's first I've heard of Emily. And there are people who go to Morton College going, that explains what we experience at the college.
Now, interesting, too, that Gene, the bookstore operator there, good friend of mine, he tells me that the case is still unsolved, and they think they're about to break the case. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Wow.
If there's finally an arrest, if there's finally some resolution to that case. Because as... many of your listeners know, and we all know, when things are unsolved, when there's no closure, that's when things haunt. That's why things act up. And that's why major disasters around Chicago, where there's no plaque or marker or no indication it's special, have caused this ripple effect of hauntings for many, many years and decades.
Wow.
Richard Crow, Chicago's ghost hunter. And some friends are in the house with us at News Talk 720 WGN.
And we're getting emailed already from people who are clamoring for, you know what they're clamoring for, Richard. And yes, we will get to Resurrection Mary. If Richard had a dollar for every time he told a tale of Resurrection Mary, he wouldn't be sitting here with us. He'd be on an island somewhere, right?
You got it. A haunted island.
A haunted island, yes. But over the years, there are trends. Resurrection Mary remains the most popular ghost story. But there appear to be things that become popular. You know, not too many years ago, all things related to Al Capone, very popular in Chicago, right? Everybody wanted to know, where did Al Capone sleep? Where did he eat? Where did he hang out? You know, where did he gamble? Where were the back rooms that you could find Al Capone? Where was his ghost walking? And we were just talking off the air about the popularity of the book, The Devil in White City. And you also do a tour taking people to the places that... were real places during the fair here in Chicago. Tell us about how people react when they go on the Devil in White City tour.
Well, my Devil in White City tour starts out with Burnham material and everything, and with the
Daniel Burnham,
the World's Fair, the designer of the World's Fair, and aspects of the World's Fair, such as the first Ferris wheel was at the World's Fair back in 1893. And then I show them the Ferris wheel at Navy Pier and explain it's only two-thirds the size of the first one.
I think those cars on that first Ferris wheel.
The cars are massive.
They would hold like 50 or 60 people.
Right.
And it's hard to imagine that somebody would take a chance and then put that up in the air and put humanity in it and say, "Whoa, look at this!" And they're paying for the thrill.
And then we talk about, L. Frank Baum connection, because The Wizard of Oz was written by L. Frank Baum in Chicago, who was inspired to write about an Emerald City based on the White City, which is the World's Fair.
Oh, I guess I didn't realize that.
And then we go to Oz Park.
Uh-huh.
And we see, did you see the new statue of Dorothy that went in last year?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, they've got a statue of Dorothy now. They started with the Tin Woodsman. And then they got the Cowardly Lion, then the Scarecrow, and now they've got Dorothy and Toto. And there were yellow bricks. You could get a yellow brick around the statue for, I forget, $100 or something last year as to be a supporter of the park. And so I've got my old gold brick there, my yellow brick. And but the thing about that that's so interesting is that people don't realize that The Wizard of Oz was a big allegory about the 1896 and 1900 political elections, which is very important today. I mean, it sounds like it's ancient history, but everything in The Wizard of Oz was about the big clash between those who wanted money backed, paper money backed by gold, the gold bugs they called them, or those who wanted silver and gold, a bimetallic system. They were the silver bugs. And William Jennings Bryan, the Democrat, wanted silver and gold, and the Republicans under McKinley just wanted gold. And so that's what all that gold and silver was all about. Because in the book, it wasn't ruby slippers on Dorothy's feet, but silver. So silver trotting on the gold. And the Wicked Witch of the East and the Wicked Witch of the West, the East was the bankers, and the West was the mining and the railroad magnates. And then the good witches were the North and the South, which represented the common man who fought a civil war because of the monetary forces that pushed people into it.
And again, and, written right here in Chicago.
Right, and you'll never guess who the Flying Monkeys represent. The Pinkerton Detective Agency.
Oh, you're kidding.
Wow.
Who did all the dirty work for the rich people, yes.
Huh, it gives me no appreciation for the movie.
Right. And what's so interesting, and then people go, oh, no, and I said, well, think about it. Dorothy was the heroine, this naive individual who went on this trip with her compadres here and then wised up here about things. And Dorothy rearranged the syllables Theodore Roosevelt, who became president after McKinley was shot.
Wow. So,
and now look what we've got in this country. Now we've got the same banking problems we had in the old days, you know?
Yeah.
And now we have to bail out the bankers and we have to take care of the currency and everything else.
So that then is the history of the Emerald City, as written by Baum, here in, born and raised here in Chicago, ties in with White City, which was the fair.
Right.
Because that was going on during the time when he was doing his writings. And then there's that dark side of the White City, as in the devil in the White City.
Right.
Mass
and then,
murderer.
And then we've got the granddaddy of all serial killers here, starting out here in Chicago. And that was Herman Mudgett, who used the alias H.H. Holmes, because probably he was so well-read he knew about this fictional character Sherlock Holmes in, in England, and took on the moniker H.H. Holmes.
And it's interesting that history hasn't treated him the way Jack the Ripper was treated, but he was probably worse than Jack the Ripper.
Absolutely, because Jack the Ripper killed five, and there's 27 plus that are
that we know.
Chalked up, that we know of, for Herman Mudgett. And he operated from 63rd and Wallace. But, you know, I think one of the reasons why it's not widely known today is because the authorities don't want it to be known, because look at what it did. Here was a guy killing people wholesale in Chicago, but he wasn't apprehended here. He was apprehended in Pennsylvania for a single crime, for killing his business partner, Pitzer. And then it turns out that he had this murder machine, this castle full of rooms with gas chambers and acid
hideous
baths.
Hideous
Torture items and all that. And everybody's oblivious. The police never caught on to it until he was caught in another state for another crime. So, in other words, it didn't make the authorities look very good here in Chicago.
So when you go by that location where the council was, people don't want to get out of the bus.
Oh, that's so funny. People refuse to get off the bus, Johnny. It's just amazing. We come west from the World's Fair area around the Museum of Science and Industry. We go past the Midway, and then we go down 63rd Street. And when we get to 63rd and Wallace, that's where we find the Inglewood Post Office. And that's where this murder castle had existed, because after Mudgett was uncovered, after he was found out, the police went in, they found all the evidence. But then, for whatever reason, it was set on fire by arson. By some arsonists, and burned to the ground, and nobody wanted it. So for decades, that plot was empty, until the federal government took it over, and in 1938 built the post office there. So it's a post office right on the spot, and as you know, you build on top of a spot where something happened, mm-hmm. you still have the ghosts around, or you still have bad luck, whatever. And so people absolutely refuse to get off the bus. Maybe about one in every five tours do people actually venture off to take photographs. Mm. It's so funny. My driver, Gaston, and I laugh about it, because we're going, I wonder what's going to happen today. I've got two coming up. I've got Wednesday. I've got a Devil in White City tour, and I've got one coming up on Sunday. And we're going to be taking bets about how many people are going to actually get off when we get to the spot to check it out.
If you're just joining us, Chicago's ghost hunter Richard Crow is in the studio with us. You can access his website by going to WGNRadio.com, click on Steve and Johnny, and we have a link right through to Richard's website. And speaking of cyberspace things, email from Lee, who wanted to know, are there any ghost stories associated with Route 66?
Well, along Route 66, we've got... straight shot all the way down through Cicero into Berwyn. And I'll tell you one thing that's interesting. Did you know that the White Fence Farm on Route 66, that was part of the old Peabody property? Remember Peabody's tomb?
Yeah.
Did we ever do that story?
No, I don't think we did. No, tell us.
Francis Peabody was a robber baron who was a coal miner. He was a strip miner back in the early 1900s, and he made a fortune because he supplied the coal for the Commonwealth Edison Company under Samuel Insull. And he had 1,000 acres in Oakbrook that ran from 31st Street to 55th Street, from Route 83 to Midwest Avenue. And here he was going to live like royalty in a big mansion, which is still there. Slate roof, timber, and plaster construction like something out of Stratford-upon-Avon. Hmm. He had kennels for his hounds. He had a stable for his horses. He was going to be a fox hunter and a country gentleman. Hmm. And but he was yet so paranoid that Peabody had secret tunnels and passages built all over the property, because one day he thought there'd be a revolution and the workers would come looking for him. Well, Peabody fell off his horse, was thrown by the horse, we don't know for sure, and died back in the mid-20s. And he was buried in the ground beneath a chapel. That chapel acquired the nickname of Peabody's Tomb.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, when I was a teenager, back in the 60s, for instance, when you got your car keys, when you turned 16 and got some vehicular freedom, you'd drive out there, park on the edge of the property, sneak on the land, and you'd have to go to the chapel, go inside, and you'd find Peabody bubbling around in a vat of formaldehyde. Then you'd take off without being caught by the monks who guarded the property, because mm-hmm. if they caught you, they'd make you kneel and pray all night, kneeling on marbles or pebbles until it's time to go home, until the sun comes up. And I know it sounds crazy, but they actually did that, the Franciscan fathers, actually. And the story is, the explanation, the partial explanation, if you will, after Peabody, this very wealthy eccentric, died, his son Jack, who was a drunkard ne'er-do-well, sold the land to the Franciscan fathers in St. Louis, and then they opened up, they eventually had a seminary there, St. Joseph Seminary, and they had a dormitory next to the mansion where they would have religious retreats, and I went there when I was a kid. And so the body in a glass case story even has an explanation. Peabody's not in a glass case, but the Franciscans had a glass reliquary containing a wax body with the bones of St. Innocent, a little boy who died a Christian martyr 2,000 years ago, and his body was found in the catacombs. The bones are painstakingly put back together. And that little reliquary with the bones inside was given by the Poor Clare Sisters in Italy to the Franciscans of the Midwest to thank them for their work during a post-World War I Reconstruction. And so there is a glass body, there is a glass encased body, but it's not Peabody.
Mm-hmm.
But then I find in recent years, you see, the property eventually was sold by the Franciscans. They whittled it down over the years. It went from 1,000 acres to about 100 acres. And it's now 100 acres part of the DuPage County Forest Preserves. And when DuPage took over, first they had a forest ranger in there. Then they had a couple who were managing the property. And they would see a little boy. Little dark boy with a dark mop of hair in his head looking out the window facing south. And he would be looking for the servants' quarters. And I was there up in the servants' quarters some time ago, and they still had the mattresses lying there on the poured concrete floor of the mansion where Peabody's servants used to live years ago. They never threw it away. They just kept it there. Hmm. And then next to that area, the common area where they had a slop sink and they had these mattresses on the floor, was a special room. And they had a room with a walk-in cedarwood closet. Well, who could be living up there with the servants tucked away like that? It was Peabody's mistress. And he would use these secret tunnels and passageways to sneak from the family quarters of the mansion to sneak over to where the servants were, and he had his way with his mistress. And supposedly, that's the little boy, the love child of his mistress that Peabody never acknowledged. So the poor kid died at a age of 8 or 9 or whatever, of some childhood illness or injury, and he's still up there, little ghost trapped, looking out the window, trying to find somebody to acknowledge him, because Peabody never accepted him, never admitted that. So what a tragic story, but
yeah.
What a great story there. And the mansion is a super place to go and visit, part of the DuPage County Forest Preserves. They have a Shakespearean stage out there now, mm-hmm. and you can rent it for weddings.
Oh.
And my friend Joe Carmia got married out there recently, and a few years back, and it's a great place to get married, but be married in Peabody's tomb, married in the chapel. But that's the story of Peabody's tomb. And what so many don't realize is that what people thought was true was the false part, and they didn't even know about the other side of it with a little boy that haunts the top floor.
Mm. Well, speaking of these amazing estates and such, are there any stories surrounding Colonel McCormick's Cantini?
You know, that's a good one. I think there's got to be something out there. I have not looked into that, but I am going to have to do that.
He had secret rooms and elevators and...
Yeah, that seems to go along with being an eccentric millionaire, having the capability of having all this kind of
secret the money.
Activity, right?
Yeah,
right.
You say, well, I just want the catacombs built in my estate. And
yeah, I always think of those movies where you've got the painting of the wall and the eyes go back and forth.
Or the library books there, and you pull out one book and the wall spins around.
Right.
You know, it's like Abbott and Costello. Then you're in another dimension when you swing around to the other side of the wall. Yeah, that is apparently, we've only been on the grounds, not inside the mansion itself, but the mansion is supposed to be just an awesome
I was
structure.
There. I have not been there in years, I must admit, but I saw all the World War I recreation, mm-hmm. the trenches uh-huh. and everything.
And military museum.
It's fabulous, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, speaking of Colonel McCormick, and I hesitate to ask, since we are sitting in the WGN Radio Studios in Tribune Tower, are there any ghost stories associated with Tribune Tower?
Well, you know, Steve, I've always wondered about all those bits of architecture from around the world that we have studded here in the facade, a piece of the Alamo and a piece of the Parthenon. And
Stonehenge.
A piece of everything.
The Great Wall of China.
There's a rock for a piece of a stone from just about everything out there stuck into the outside facade of the building. I love going around there looking at all these different stones.
Because you've got to imagine if there's some... I hesitate to say. Oh, I'm among friends. Vibration from some of these places.
Right.
Because some of these places are not the most positive places in the world. And you think, well, gee, you know, here they're all kind of gathered together in one location. You almost
exactly.
think there would
they
be
have
a vibration.
Have a lot of emotion there in those stones. But I'll tell you one that they're missing. One piece they're missing would be a brick from the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And I had been talking to Rick Kogan about donating a brick from the St. Valentine's Day Massacre to be put into the wall. I'm not sure. When's the last time they had an addition to the collection out here?
That's a good question.
Certainly before we came here. We've been here for almost
It may have been the Moon Rock.
It may have been before
I think
the
that
building was given landmark status, too, because now wouldn't that be the kind of thing that they would have to have approved if you wanted to modify the facade in any way?
Interesting, but that wouldn't be a major change in it, but it may well be. Because when you get the National Register of Historic Places registration, you have to keep the exterior the same, but you don't have to do the interior. But now, you know, with the Biograph Theater, for instance, they put the new marquee on there and the new ticket box because, oh, my God, we would be out there on tour, be raining rust on us from the old marquee. It was in such a bad condition.
And it's beautiful now. The theater is so nice. Inside, it's absolutely gorgeous, too. But back to the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, for people who don't know, that actually occurred just about... what, 20-something blocks north of here?
2122 North Clark Street, yes. That's like one of those trivia questions. Tell if somebody's really a Chicagoan, ask them what was the address of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. If they don't know that, if they don't know what you get on the Maxwell Street Polish, or they don't know the address of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, they're not really a Chicagoan.
Number three is if they ask for ketchup on their hot dog, that's it. You've had your membership card taken away, right?
Absolutely.
Let's jump to some phone calls, and Tom is in Indiana. Hi, Tom. You're on WGN Radio with Richard Crowe.
Yeah, hi. I want to tell you something about what happened to my mom and I. I live down here in Indianapolis, and my mom lives up in Munster. And, Steve, I believe your brother lives there?
Yes, he does.
Okay. She lived alone. She had a caretaker. She was bedridden. And my father passed away, and it was just, I'm an only child. Mm-hmm. I never married, so just all I had was my mom when my dad passed away. And oddly enough, she listened to WGN all night, and she had Spike Odell on the radio. And my dad passed away, and he appeared to my mom in the bedroom, and he's, you know, looked at her, and he says, "I'll be there for you and Tom." And then just like a mist disappeared, and the sun was shining through the drapes. My mom's sitting, she's awake, you know, she knows this. And the odd thing was, the night my dad passed away, we're down in the basement going into the safe to get the life insurance policy to give to the funeral director, and we heard footsteps upstairs. It was heavy footsteps from a man. And we didn't think anything of it, and then we heard the second time, and we just looked at each other, our eyes bugged out. I said, "Did you hear that before?" My mom said, "Yes." I said, "Somebody's in the house." So I went up there. I didn't see anything. And but what happened, my mom told me when she saw my dad's, you know, spirit, ghost, whatever. And I took over 80% chance because they had such a beautiful marriage. They were so much in love. And it was a perfect marriage. They're the greatest parents. And so I said, "Well, you know, believe it, 80%. Well, the caretaker that was living with my mom, taking care of her because she was bedridden, about 2 months later, she went down the basement to take a shower. I have a shower stall in the basement. And she came up screaming. And she says, "Stanley's in the basement." Well, she knew who he was because we had a family portrait in the living room. He looked like. And he was, and we have a finished basement, and she said he was sitting at a bar stool at the end of the bar. And my mom says, "Did he have a white shirt on, and was he smiling?" She said, "Yes, because my dad always wore a white shirt."
Oh, my gosh.
Red shirts. And then she went back downstairs and didn't see him anymore, and I never saw him. So maybe he crossed over.
But now she ran from the basement screaming, but it doesn't mean that she was scared by this. It was just the fact that there was somebody in the basement.
No, she recognized it was a ghost. You know, my dad looked like.
I love that. She just knew it was a ghost. You know, who else would be sitting around the bar?
Rather matter of fact.
Yeah. Anyway, I sold the house. My mom passed away, and I sold the house. I told the listing agent about this.
Did you?
And I says, "Don't tell the people buying the house about this that, you know, it's possibly haunted, you know, because my dad crossed over, you know, he's not going to be back." But coincidentally, who bought the house was a church minister. He bought the house there in a church there in Munster. He's a member of a church there in Munster. And I'll tell you where the house is at. You want to take it off the air?
Well, that's okay. But did you find out from the minister if anything ever happened?
I haven't been in contact with him, and nothing happened to me because when my mom passed away, I was up to about every 3 weeks.
Well, from what you describe, I don't think he's going to be there. I think he's... You see, there's haunted places, haunted objects, haunted people. And when you've got a ghost, somebody who cares a lot about somebody and wants to be a protector, they follow them around wherever they go. And that's what you're going to have in this situation.
So when your mother crossed over...
And you're not necessarily going to be you know, hearing anything or seeing anything here, unless you're really in trouble, and then it's nice to know you got a helping hand from beyond.
Like your guardian angel.
Right. Watching you. It is exactly like a guardian angel.
Tom, if you'll hold on off the air, if we can get the address of that house.
Out of curiosity.
Kind of curious. Let's jump to Dave, who is in Iowa. What part of Iowa, Dave?
I'm sitting here in Altoona.
All right.
I grew up in Tri-State.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of Hinsdale, I remember Peabody's tomb. I hadn't heard anybody talk about that in years. There's a couple other interesting places. One of them's not haunted, I don't think, but it may be, is Mr. Cuneo on Libertyville, his mansion. I used to work for him. I was a bodyguard for him. And inside of his house, there's a Kaiser's rug he got from the Kaiser and a suit of armor. And then there is a church. I call it a church. Other people may call it a chapel. But Cardinal Cody used to come out there and give him mass. And there's pictures in there of of Cardinal Cody, John F. Kennedy, and his wife, and getting services in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another one that most people don't know, and I don't know if you guys will know where it's at. Going out of Chicago, out by, I think it's either Cass Avenue, there used to be an old Army base, and there's a Nike base, and there's Rocky Glen. If you go past the Nike base, which now would be I-55 going towards Bolingbrook, about 5 miles past that Nike base, on the left-hand side, used to be a house, a big mansion with a big fence around it and a water tower that used to belong to Al Capone.
Oh.
Now, that one I don't know about. Al Capone has so many different connections around.
Yeah.
Is that near Argonne Laboratory?
Yep. If you...
That's not on Rainbow, is it, where they found those bodies some years ago?
Oh, it may be. I haven't been back. I left Tri-State in 1967 when I went into the service, and I really haven't been back, but... Mm-hmm. I remember that as a kid and as a teenager. It was something. That one there, and the other one was Mr. Butler, who lived in Oak Brook, Illinois.
Right. Another very wealthy man.
Back in the 60s, he was the first person that ever had a traffic light at the end of his driveway that stopped the
street.
Plus, back then, the Oak Brook police, which there wasn't many of them then.
Yeah.
I think like one or two, I forget how many actually. They used to ride around in Cadillacs for drug.
Oh my gosh.
Must have been nice.
Yeah. So do we know anything about hauntings around the Butlers?
Well, that's just east of the Peabody House, too.
Yeah.
That's just east of Mays Lake.
I'm trying to see if there was something to do with the land out there more than the people.
I never made it in all the way into Peabody's. None of us did. We all got scared off.
I could tell by that chuckle that there's some fond memories of your misspent youth.
There is. There was stories about Rocky Glen over there by Argonne National Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
There were some other stories that if you went down, let's see, south on 83 over the canal. And I think it was after the first bridge.
Mm-hmm.
You made a sharp left-hand turn and went back about a half mile off to the right, I think it was. It may be to left, and got out of the car and walked way back into the woods. You would find plaques from when the atomic bomb was built, that there were certain things in that area that was from that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. And, Richard, I know you've talked often about the significance of a body of water being near an area that's haunted.
And, of course, that's the Des Plaines River out there.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a lot of connections with the Des Plaines.
And you also have the history of the Indians living along that body of water, too. So,
well, that old Willow Shopping Mall out there on Archer, when you get out about 91st Street, that was built on Indian burial ground, allegedly. And that would certainly explain why businesses, a lot of trouble with businesses there. The world's largest limousine went out of business out there, and a bunch of other situations out there. Yeah.
In fact, for people new to our conversations, If you could explain a little bit, why is there a significance with ghost stories and bodies of water?
Well, I'll go back to my English literature background on that one. One of my favorite stories from childhood, actually, was The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Mm. And Washington Irving wrote about Ichabod Crane, or the Headless Horseman ghost. And to get away from the Headless Horseman, Ichabod Crane had to cross over running water. And, you know, I did spend a few days up in that area of upstate New York. I visited Washington Irving's home a few years back. And what's interesting is that they have historical material up there that Washington Irving didn't create this stuff out of whole cloth. It was actually based on local legends about Headless Horsemen and all that. And the concept of ghosts being found near running water, but they cannot cross running water, is more than just American. It goes back to Europe. It goes back to, for instance, the poem Tam O'Shanter by Scottish national poet Robbie Burns. You have Tam crossing over the Brigadoon, the Bridge of the Verdun, to get away from the ghost witch Cutty Sark. And then in the old vampire tales in Central Europe, vampires are found near running water, but they can't cross running water. And this is not just a European belief, but I mean, it goes, the Chinese with their feng shui, they recognize the importance of water. Water is extremely important.
That's why you often will have fountains or
you have a fountain, but also you don't even need the real thing, but you can have a representation of it and a picture of water. Mm-hmm. And when they have the picture, they'll have like goldfish in it, which means the water is drinkable because the fish aren't dead.
Ah.
And they're gold, this, you know, color of wealth, and the number of fish. If you ever count them in these paintings, it's always like eight.
Never four.
Eight or nine. Yeah. Four is the death number. Eight's for abundance, for prosperity. Nine's for infinity. And what they'll often do is they'll like have eight gold, and then the ninth fish will be black. It'll be like the scapegoat fish. Mm. And so you've got a combination of both eight and nine.
And again, Midwestern legend has it that with all of the Indians around here, there was also the belief that you were safe if the ghosts were coming after you, if you could cross that body of water.
Well, I mean, here we have a state named after an Indian tribe, no longer here, and our city's named after an Indian tribe, an Indian name. Sadly, we don't have any Indians anymore, but
in fact, have the Chicago River and the Des Plaines River and, of course, Lake Michigan.
And I often wondered about, why they wanted to get rid of Chief Lanawick when they ought to just change the name of Illinois to Caponia in honor to have one of the more corrupt states in the United States have it named
Caponia
after American Indians. I mean, that's an insult to the Indians.
That's,
you know, tying them with political corruption. Let's call it Caponia and get it over with.
Get Blago on the phone right now. I think that's a great idea. He can throw himself behind that one.
David, thank you for your call. 591-7200, the phone number. Richard Crowe, Chicago's ghost hunter, is in the studio with us, and you can check out his website, which is ghosttours.com, and you have your Halloween tour schedule, your special edition tour. What are some of the places that you have to cover, some of the places you have to take tours to as we get close to Halloween?
Well, Johnny said, Resurrection Mary is so popular, I do the Resurrection Mary material on both the matinee tour and the evening tour. Mm-hmm. That's how popular Resurrection Mary is. But when I do it geographically, so when I do the night route, that stays in the city, and that's going to have urban disasters like the Eastland and like the Iroquois Theater fire. It's going to have gangster material like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and John Dillinger, but also ethnic neighborhoods like Chinatown with the most haunted block, 22nd place in Chinatown. And
why is that the most haunted block? What are some of the things that have happened there?
Why is it the most haunted block? Let me put it this way. When the Chinese began to come to Chicago just before 1910, it was right after the San Francisco earthquake and fire, which devastated Chinatown and San Francisco, and now we had a lot of Chinese traveling about the country. So they came to Chicago, and they cut a deal with the Italians, as they often live next to Italians, like New York City, and you've got Little Italy and Chinatown back-to-back. And then they find out, to their chagrin, that they're on top of an Indian burial ground, because that's the land, the high ground, just to the south of the bend of the Chicago River there, where Pingtown Park is now. And so that's an Indian burial ground in that area. So they use feng shui. They use other methods here of controlling balance and harmony, so they don't have trouble. But for whatever reason, that one short block between Wentworth and Princeton, a 22nd place, has at least five different ghost stories. But I'll tell you, one of my favorites is at my friend Ling Tin's restaurant, the Triple Crown. Now, Ling's been in there since the 90s. However, prior to that, there was no restaurant in the building. It was an apartment building. And that's where a man, heavily in debt with gambling problems, decided he couldn't pay and his life was ruined, so he commits suicide. He puts a plastic bag in his head and he duct tapes that to his neck and he kills himself. But he still owes, even though he's dead. Mm-hmm. And he's seen walking around the kitchen restroom area, semi-transparent, and he's seen washing dishes and plates on a busy night trying to pay off the debt.
Oh.
Now, you've got an interesting tie-in here, because he's seen around the washroom a lot. He's seen around water. Mm-hmm. You know, in a Chinese restaurant, if you've got a leaky faucet or anything, that's considered extremely bad luck, because the loss of the water is going to represent loss of income, because water is so important in feng shui.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy also, by cutting off the air supply to his brain, left this world confused. And that's why I think he's an active one. But, you know, out in front, I think we talked about this last year, is that little Chinese lady, about 5 foot tall, silver hair, cut in a bob, wears a burgundy jacket and hood, and singles out the straggler in my group to talk to, and says things like, where do you shop? I like to shop at Dominic's. I like Dominic tea. And very interesting, you know, nonchalant type conversation like that. And she's right out in front of that spot, right in front of the restaurant. So there's two right there. And then there's other stuff in that block, too. That block.
And again, why don't you, again, for people who didn't hear our conversation last year, why was that strange for this woman to come up and talk to someone in your group?
Well, what's interesting is that it was happening singularly to individuals. You know, somebody would tell me later, hey, who's that little Chinese in your group today? I said, we don't have one. And I thought at first they were picking up a local person, but it kept happening again and again with the exact same description of her dress. It even happened to my mom one time. But it was a year ago, April, when I was doing a tour for a group of retired postal employees, and we were doing our walking tour in Chinatown, and we these people were adamant, you know, we don't want to see a ghost. We just came here to eat, to shop, and to hear your stories, but we don't want to have anything happen today. We don't want to see anything. I said, well, I can't guarantee it, but because it's warm today, I wouldn't suspect we're going to be able to see this ghost because she's dressed for winter. And so we're walking around for about a half an hour, and then I feel somebody tugging at my sleeve, and they're pointing, and there she was, 7-8 feet away from me, in front of this one grocery store, the Don Quixote store, a variety store that we went to. We're leaving the store, and she's right there in our midst, and I'm trying to jockey around in front of her to look her in the eye, and she kept, you know, looking the other way, and finally I'm distracted for just 1 second, and then she was gone. And so I saw her plain as day. And now, the thing is, how do I know it's the ghost? Well, she had the silver hair cut in a bob. She's about 5 foot tall, looked about 80 years of age, but she wasn't wearing the jacket and hood. She wasn't wearing it because it was too warm, but she was hugging it to her chest. She had it with her.
Wow.
And it was just amazing. I couldn't have hired somebody from Central Casting to pull that off any better.
There's a guy that actually is with Richard when these things happen, and we're going to talk with him in just a moment on News Talk 720 WGN.
We've got a lot of people hanging on the lines, and we also have the man who accompanies Richard Crowe on a lot of his tours.
The man who can back him up on these tales of the supernatural. He is the bus driver for Richard, Gastone. How are you tonight, Gastone?
Oh, how are you there, Johnny?
Very good.
Hey,
thank
we
you.
Are still waiting for you to ride in with us.
I'm too scared.
Look, I told you that time we hold your hand.
I know.
Hold your hand, and I hold the other hand, and we can take you anywhere, and not be scared.
Now, Richard was telling that story about Chinatown. You were there the day when he saw the little.
No, he wasn't there in that because that was a walking tour.
Right. But you've been there with many of these very, very scary.
Well, Gaston, why don't you mention how the people are afraid to get off when we go to Murder Castle site?
Oh, yeah. You know, when we're driving around in the Devil of the White City tour, a new one Richard has. People, we went to the place in the by the post office where the murder occurred, and people is scared to get out.
In daylight.
In the sunshine, summertime, no matter what time of the year it is, they are afraid to get out.
Well, now, Gaston, you've been driving the bus for years with Richard. Yeah. Have you seen things that are unexplainable?
With the people around, especially, you know, in the, like in the whole house, stuff mm-hmm. like that, by the university, people show me things, and I've seen things who I cannot clear up myself, you know, mm-hmm. like weird things.
Yeah, we've been having a rash of orb photographs lately there,
that's
right, Gaston?
Right.
People are picking up things left and right at Hull House lately.
Yeah. Well, are they using digital cameras?
Right, on digital cameras, right.
Yeah, you can see it in the digital camera how it happened, you know. It's no glare or anything like that. It's, mm-hmm. it's weird things.
Right.
And Gaston, why don't you mention about how when we go by the Resurrection Mausoleum, how we see the lights on when they should not be on all the time, huh?
Oh, yeah, the mausoleum in the Resurrection, you know, sometimes the lights, they are on in one floor, and the other time we go on and they are off, mm-hmm. and some they are irregular time, life changes all the time.
Hmm.
So if
yeah, it's been rewired a couple of times. You still can't get it right. And, of course, as we've been talking earlier, ghosts can screw around with your electricity very easily.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And this isn't a case of lights on a timer or anything. These are just lights that are on when they're not supposed to be on.
Because it's a crazy pattern, a patch here, a patch there, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You think, I've been driving for Richard for a few years already. Mm-hmm. And Richard have another driver from our company. And the guy is scared and said, I don't want to go with no more with this guy.
Really?
In fact, Richard, isn't it true that that the driver before Gaston got scared the night of the incident that we've talked about at the Museum of Science
right,
and Industry?
Right, because the night that we had the Science and Industry sighting of Clarence Darrow, that was right before I came on the show, and I brought the people down from the bus. So Steve and Johnny remember that well. I'll never forget that night.
And we've seen the videotape. In fact, if you want to briefly explain what happened that night for people that are new to our conversation.
Right. Well, I changed my tour around every few years, so I'm not using this site on a regular basis right now. But back then, in 95, we would go to the Museum of Science and Industry, the rear entrance, and that's adjacent to the Jackson Park Lagoon. Over the Jackson Park Lagoon is a bridge known as the Clarence Darrow Memorial Bridge, because the cremains, the ashes of Clarence Darrow, were scattered there back in 1938 after his death and cremation. He had lived in the area. He had been living in the area since he fell in love with the area from the World's Fair of 1893, in fact, and the celebrated attorney who, by the way, broadcast the first trial live on radio from this station, WGN, the Scopes Monkey Trial, back in 1925. And closely associated with Chicago, of course, and he wants to spend eternity here. And he promised his son, in a pledge very reminiscent to what Harry Houdini promised his wife, Bess, before Houdini died in 1926, Darrow promised his son he would come back from the dead and give a sign, and that's why people gather here, waiting for his ghost to show up or some sign from beyond on the anniversary, which would be March 13th, 10 a.m. March 13th every year. But I decided, come on, this is too good a story to waste for just once a year, to just wait till March. Let's do it around Halloween. So I began to come out here on Halloween, and that's how we saw him. And we saw him show up walking down the sidewalk across the lagoon on the other side of the water from where we were, wearing a 1930s outfit, Homburg hat, camel hair coat. And he walked, stopped, stared at the water, and we got it all on video camera. We're screaming, yelling. The guy's paying no attention. Then he does a half turn and walks back the way he came around the side of the building and was gone. And, well, you saw the footage here that night at the station.
Yeah, we did.
And that footage later wound up on a Learning Channel, Discovery Channel, other programs.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Paul Harvey later did an episode,
right,
Rest of the Story program, on this particular incident. But after that night, O.B. Hood, and he was a great guy, but he just couldn't hack it.
Well, the whole bus was just up in arms.
The adrenaline was really flowing.
Oh, when you all came over here with the guy who had the video camera, and you could just tell that there was this breathlessness about what you just experienced.
Right.
I was not at all surprised that Obi was out of there.
They all got their money's worth that night.
That's
yes.
Right.
But Obi quit, and now I have Gaston. And Gaston and I have a pledge, right, Gaston?
Yeah. We
break for ghosts, yes.
Oh, yeah.
That's great. Well, Gaston, we'll come see you sometime, I promise.
I wish you coming, you know, I mean, it'd be nice to see you guys
in
with us in the bus there and see if maybe you can experience some of the things.
We could do it incognito. You guys could show up in disguise with dark glasses on.
With a Hamburg hat on. Gaston, thank you so much. And again, have a happy Halloween. Take care.
News Talk 720 WGN with Steve King and Johnny Putman. If you're just joining us and you're getting out of work and you're driving down that lonely, dark road by yourself, don't be afraid. We just have Chicago's ghost hunter, Richard Crow, in the studio with us. And we've got a lot of people with some interesting emails, and we have a lot of ghost stories to get to. And yes, we will get to the story of Resurrection Mary.
Yes, and your phone calls as well. An email from Ron, who says, congratulations, Mr. Crow, on 35 years of the most fascinating ghost stories. Thank you for your service to ghosts.
Wow.
That's nice.
That is nice.
And after 35 years, Richard is now, he's the subject of a play. The only play of its kind about a living ghost hunter. The play is entitled The Brides of Ghost Hunter Richard Crow.
What did you think when you heard this was going to happen?
To tell you the truth, Steve, I thought, wait a minute, this is not going to fly. But it's a very nice production. The concept is that there's an actor playing me, and all these different female ghosts act out different dramatic accounts of their stories. And it ranges from everything from the wife of Pitzer and his daughter that were being gassed by the serial killer Herman Mudgett, mm-hmm. to Eastland Disaster, to various other
Haunted Hooters.
And the Haunted Hooters story is in there. Right. And so it's very nicely done. And there's a lot of little hooks in there, too, that you're going to get grabbed. You're gonna wait a minute, and you get grabbed. I don't want to give away those little hooks because they're a really interesting part of the production.
And there's a seance, too.
And there's a seance at the end, and a very curious ending and everything. So it keeps you going all through the production.
Well, did they tell you they were going to use your name and your life as, Mike Flores, who...
Mike Flores, I've known now for a number of years. You know, he first met me years ago when he found a flyer that there was going to be a lecture called Leprechauns Are Real at the Emerald Isle Pub on Pearson. And he wondered, who's this guy, Richard Crowe, trying to convince me the leprechauns are real? And he said he went there and he became convinced.
How many Guinness did he have before he became convinced?
Yeah, boy, that's a long time ago, I'm afraid, because the poor Emerald Isle is long gone now.
Yeah.
But, so Mike has known me for a long time. He's done many productions around Chicago.
But he wrote and directed
this. And for those who know my stories, for those who've read my book, for those who've followed me here, you're gonna see a lot of stuff that's going to put a smile on your face and bring you back to a lot of the classic accounts here.
Runs Friday and Saturday nights.
Right. It's going to be at the Liars Club this coming weekend. And is it 8 or 8:15?
8:15.
So, but get there around 8, and I believe they have $1 PBRs there. But and then it's upstairs in the secret room here, the meeting room, whatever. And they are looking for a new location. I know that, too, because it's been pretty successful. So they're going to be moving to another location, probably a larger location.
So it's at the Liars Club.
In the future. But right now it's still at
November
the Liars
2nd,
Club, right.
Mm-hmm. Which is a Halloween weekend.
Right. So they're still at Liars Club right now. And there's information on my website. You can get further information by just going to ghosttours.com.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who... even if you've never taken any of my tours or don't really know what I'm all about, you'll find it very interesting. You don't have to have a knowledge of this or any background in it to enjoy it. It's a regular play, but it's got that supernatural twist. And I don't want to give it away. I don't want to give you all the...
Yeah.
But there's some really interesting twists in there, especially the one about the channeling experiment. We'll leave it at that for now.
Channeling experiment. Okay, yes. So it's called The Brides of Ghost Hunter Richard Crow. This is Ghost Hunter Richard Crow with us in the studio, and you can see the play and be a part of the seance for a couple of more weeks at the Liars Club, and tickets are only $10 and show up at 8 o'clock when the door is open. The Liars Club, by the way, is at 1665 West on Fullerton here in Chicago. Easy access, perfect location.
Easy access, and there's a lot of free parking around there, too, so that's something else you can't find much around Chicago, free parking.
It's a heck of a way to celebrate your 35th year in the business, too.
Had an email from Mary, who wanted to know about a story that you've told before that involved seeing some ghost lights, and it was up around Wisconsin, and you had a, I believe, another newspaper columnist with you.
Yes, that in fact was the big breakthrough article in the paper for me here in the newspapers here in Chicago back in 1974. I did my first tours for DePaul University, my first trip for DePaul in 73, Halloween weekend. But then I was contacted by John Ziemek of the old Daily News, and he wanted to go on a ghost hunt and accompany me and write about it. And I said, well, John, you know, it's usually watching paint dry. It's usually not that exciting, but if you want to take your chances, we'll go check out a spot. And we wound up, I had a lead about a place near Bristol, you know, where the Renaissance Fair is held, and not too far from there. I can't give the precise location because the property is owned by sister and brother-in-law of a disc jockey from another station who's a good friend of mine, and they would kill me if I gave out that kind of detail right now. But when I went out there back in 74, it was abandoned property, and there were ruins of an old house. And the story was, according to the teenagers up there in Kenosha County, that that property was a gangster hideout, and that one mob found out about these rival gangsters staying there, went up there and killed them and hid their bodies in the lake nearby, which was appropriately named Ham's Lake because of all the Ham's beer cans that were found floating in it. In any event, I went up there to check it out, and very, very interesting because John Ziemek, myself, and it was Jack Parker, who was my guide, and Nancy Rivera. I remember this very well because it just made such an impact upon all of us. We go out there one night, we pull off the road, and there in the distance an oak tree, and to the right was a patch of shimmering light. And I'm going, geez, that's a funny trick of the stars in the sky. Because, you know, you get out beyond the area where all the street lamps and everything ruin your night vision.
And it's inky dark.
And you get up there into Wisconsin, and you can find places where you can really see a beautiful night sky. I thought that's all it was. So we start walking back towards it, and then that patch disappears. I'm like, that's curious. So we continue past that tree. We come to a clearing. And here we found the debris from the house that stood there, cinder blocks and so forth. And as we're checking on that, all of a sudden we notice that there is a couple of lights, silhouette shapes, if you will, darting back and forth on the edge of the clearing. Now that's really getting strange here. We're observing this. And then as that's going on, there's a bush nearby, and there's some little tiny like Christmas lights that started popping off. And I heard a voice. I heard them popping like that, and I walked up and I talked to the bush, because like my one half of the brain is thinking one thing, the other half is thinking something else, and I'm not thinking it's ghosts. I'm thinking it's got to be some kids out there hiding in the bushes for whatever reason. I said, "Come out, it's okay. We're not going to hurt you." And there was no reply, and that's when John Ziemek started saying things like, "We've got to get out of here. We're going to be murdered. You know, we're all going to die." And I'm saying, John, shut up, you know, take it all in, you know. And so though John's inability to control himself here is almost hysteria, you could call it, infected the other two, although I must admit I wasn't ready to leave. I wanted to see it all. And so I said, okay, we'll go. We went back to the car. I said, nobody say anything. And we drove to a nearby little bar and restaurant at a crossroad. I said, nobody say anything until we get here. And I gave everybody a cocktail napkin, and we all started jotting down our notes of what we observed. Then we compared them. Now, John Ziemek did not see the bush with the popping lights, or did the other two. But I saw that because I was watching that, and the rest were just taking in the other phenomena going on. But I think John Zimek was right on target, because when you dissect what he was doing, he was actually like channeling, I think, the energy that was there at the time years ago when this multiple murder took place. You know, we're going to be murdered, we're going to be killed mm-hmm. statements would be what was running through the minds of the people mm-hmm. who were about to be killed years ago. And I really feel that he was the most attuned into the situation there, more attuned than I was and the other two in our party.
And that would explain his fear, too.
Exactly. The fear and everything that he was actually reliving what happened to the wow. murder victims of years before. John wrote that up for the Daily News, and there's a minor gold rush, if you will, of people mm-hmm. trying to find the place, and they even were selling maps, like treasure maps, to the spot for a while up there, how you find the spot. And, of course, I was persona non grata by the county police up there for a while because of all the publicity. But then it turns out that the property is owned by, was purchased and still owned by the sister and brother-in-law of the disc jockey from another station. So I have my pulse on it, my finger on the pulse on it here. And things do happen low-key
mm-hmm. to nothing
the
state, like that.
But nothing quite as dramatic as when we were up there mm-hmm. that night.
It was like it was meant for you to be there that night.
Right.
Somebody wanted to say something. And
that particular story, of course, by John, that really attracted a lot of attention.
And it changed your life, too.
Yeah, that attracted a lot of attention locally here for me mm-hmm. in the area. But also, John did have that, he had that story picked up nationally. So mm-hmm. that went all over the place. And that started a lot towards building up my credibility here. Because, I mean, if I came and said that, that's one thing. But here I had a reporter mm-hmm. ready to vouch for that he had this experience.
I hear that story, and every time I hear it, I say, wow, I'm glad it was John and not Johnny.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't...
I'll take you guys up there.
Oh, okay. I don't think so.
As long as we don't,
don't
divulge the location, but I'll tell you exactly how to find it.
Nope.
When you go up for a turkey leg Renaissance Fair, always think about the spot
and
nearby.
And that's where Steve asked me to marry him, was at Renaissance Fair.
I didn't realize that.
Yes, we were the king and queen of the fair.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all dressed up riding on the back of an elephant when he asked me to marry him. And I still said yes. Riding.
That was back when it was still fun, right?
Before
it got politically correct.
It was fun. You had dirt eaters.
They got rid of the gypsy dance troupe.
Yes.
They got rid of the pirate wenches.
This is when you still had all
girls.
It was,
all the cool acts.
A friend of Johnny's was one of the dirt eaters.
Yeah, for money. Yeah. He would grab clumps of dirt and eat it.
Don't have them anymore either, do they?
No, they don't. No. He went on to be a dentist.
Really?
Yeah.
A lot of people hanging on the lines, and let's jump to George, who is in Barrington Hills and on WGN Radio with Richard Crowe. Hi, George. What can we do for you?
Well, good morning.
Hey,
morning.
George.
Good morning.
This happened a few years ago. Now, just to give you a quick background, I grew up in the city, so I'm a skeptic by upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
But my wife and I and my oldest daughter were out looking at real estate a few years ago, and there's an architect, I've been told, by the name of Robert Parker, and he's the fellow out in Long Grove. There's a road called Robert Parker Coffin Road that leads right into town. Anyhow, as I was told, he designed a well-known house out where County Line Road, Lake Cook Road, almost out to King County.
Mm-hmm.
So we go to look at this old house out there, and it's an old English-style country house set way back from the road, maybe 600-800 feet. And it's white clad, and it's got a cedar-shaped roof, and the place was abandoned. So we go in there with the realtor stays outside. We go inside, and we're looking around. The house, the only updated feature was a huge kitchen from the 50s, you know, with pink and green. The rest of the house was, as you might imagine, with wooden shutters and fireplaces. It was lovely, but it was obviously something that needed a lot of upkeep. So we go downstairs. I went downstairs with my wife and my two daughters, and I went immediately at the bottom of the stairs to check the furnace and look at the water heaters. And to our left was a corridor with a series of rooms, and my wife and my oldest daughter, they go down the hallway, and I hear one of them comment, "Oh, look, you know, a wine cellar, and there's a bunch of wine." So I'm not paying any attention to what they're doing. In fact, I can't even see what they're doing. I'm looking at a furnace that was probably put in the late 50s. And I wasn't terribly impressed with it. And I'm ready to go upstairs. I wasn't curious about anything else. And so I'm waiting for them, and they come down this hallway, and they're very quiet. Because normally they're quite talkative, as you might imagine. I've got a household full of young ladies, and
mm-hmm.
it's like girls' softball team around here. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, we go upstairs, and nobody's saying anything. We go outside, and my eldest daughter turns to me, and she's in her early 20s at the time, and she says, "Dad, did you hear it?" I said, "Did I hear what?" She says, "Those girls laughing and giggling." I said, "What girls? What are you talking about?" She says, "When we were down there and we looked at the wine cellar, as we turned around and shut the door, we heard sounds like two little girls laughing and giggling." I looked at Mom. Mom looked at me. We didn't say anything. And we came up the hallway, and you were waiting there for us by the furnace room. I said, "You didn't say anything." I said, "No, we didn't. But we could still hear them." And we went upstairs, and that's when we followed you right out of the house. So it turns out the realtor tells us right after that that, yes, there was... There'd been rumors that the house had been haunted, but, normally she doesn't say anything unless somebody asks.
Uh-huh.
So it turns out that we ended up buying a property not too far away from there, and periodically I'll go over there, and I don't believe in ghosts, but I get this warm feeling when I'm over there, and I look up in the windows late at night.
It's still empty?
It's still empty.
Oh.
And I'll say to them, "Well, if there's ghosts over there, and we happen to live, you know, in the vicinity, why don't we ever see them over here?"
Uh-huh.
And they say, "I don't know." But I know that I go over there, if one of our dogs runs away or something, I'll go over there, 2-3 in the morning. You know, I'll look up in the windows to see if there's a light or anything. I don't see anything. But to this day, my wife and my daughter insist, clear as day, that they heard little girls laughing and giggling. And that was they look at me like, you know, I cross my heart, you know.
Mm-hmm. You can
Richard,
tell that, yeah.
What can you read into that? Or what?
Well, I'm just curious, a few more questions, if I may. How long ago, since it's been empty, I mean, how long has it been since somebody's lived there?
Well, it has been unoccupied now probably for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And
that
the person,
in itself is kind
the person
of
who lived there last had lived in the house for about 40 years.
And did the realtor know any story about what the haunting was or
as you might imagine, they weren't too
forthcoming.
Yeah,
comment on our follow up on that. A couple of years after that happened, somebody knocks on the door and says, "Hi, I grew up next door. You want to take a walk over there and go look at the house?" Now, I wasn't home there at the time. This is my wife.
Uh-huh.
I said, "What did you?" We went next door. Woman's in her 20s. She said, "Yeah, I'm estranged from my parents, where my dad passed away. I don't know where my mom is, but I grew up in this house." And she told my wife that when they were little, that they used to hear sounds at night, and they didn't know what it was from either.
Oh, that's an even more bizarre element, though, that this estranged family member comes back.
And again, before they heard...
I didn't even tell your producer that, but that, in fact, happened. That was the last year pretty bizarre.
Yeah.
But again, before they heard these sounds of little girls, no one had told them about
a haunting.
The haunting.
Yeah, it wasn't a self-fulfilling
prophecy. And it's still listed? They're still trying to sell it?
Oh, no.
It's just sitting there.
Well, actually, what finally happened is it finally went into foreclosure.
Uh-huh.
And it's been tied up for a few years now. But it's...
Well, that is your mission now, is to keep an eye on that house now.
Well, you know, Richard, it's funny you say that, because I often feel at times like I'm the caretaker.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
Well, at least you're the caretaker for the ghosts, if not for the property itself, because it seems like there's some rapport there.
Wow. Hey, George, hang on for a second, and off the air, just give, because I don't want this to end and then suddenly say, "Gee, I wish we could find George again."
No, I'll get your number, George. I'll call you here right after Halloween. How's that?
Yeah,
that's
great.
A fascinating story. And again, Richard, for anyone who, because we're getting some emails about this, people wanting to know if they can still contact you for ghost tours for the week of Halloween, any spaces available?
Well, Halloween night itself is gone. That's on a Friday, so that's definitely bad luck for people with the Halloween on Friday. But I do have, in fact, depending on how many in the group, I think I still have some on the Sunday prior. Then I know I've got Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday leading up to Halloween, including a few left on Devil's Night, October 30, which is also turning out to be, has been a very popular date as well. If you can't get on Halloween... All Saints or All Souls, and you know, go one night before. And if you, as you remember, Steve, Devil's Night was when they used to burn Detroit, and any garage or anything they could find to set on fire. But I guess there's nothing left to burn anymore. We haven't been hearing about that much in recent years.
But if people want to contact you, the number is
708-499-0300. Plus, I want to caution everybody, my website's out of date. I can't keep it up to date because things are selling so quickly.
Yeah.
And just call me. And sometimes things change. Like, I had a cancellation today for a death in the family, and I had six openings on Saturday this weekend on the matinee. Of course, I sold it within an hour. So just check with me, and I'll give you a current situation here. But please be ready to order fairly quick. You know, you can't just say, I'll call you back in a few days. It's not going to be the same.
Right, right. And if you want to wait till the Halloween season passes, you can do things like take advantage of the Chinatown.
Well, right after Halloween passes is when I segue right into my Ghost of Christmas Past Dickens theme.
Yes. Right.
So there's never a bad time.
That's right. And then there's the haunted pub crawl, and who doesn't love a pub crawl? And then you add the haunting to it.
Right.
So you can get all the information on Richard's website, or you can just call and leave a message and get more details. Say you want to have a bachelor party, you know, take the whole party on a pub crawl.
I have a police department, female police personnel coming on a tour here in a few days' time. So you never know who you're going to get.
Yeah, well, at least they'll be armed, so if anything happens,
right.
You'll be safe. Richard Crowe with us in the studio tonight. We're going to get to some email and your phone calls.
And we go to Hap, who's in Round Lake Beach and on WGN with Richard Crowe. Hi, Hap.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Do you know anything about Excalibur?
The building?
Yes, well, I'm sorry, Johnny?
You're talking about the nightclub Excalibur.
Sorry, about the nightclub Excalibur.
Correct.
The previous Limelight, and going back, in fact, to 1892, it was the Chicago Historical Society property. Now, they were in there. The Historical Society ran the property from 1892 until 1931 when they moved to their current location up in Lincoln Park, ironically on top of a cemetery, the Old City Cemetery. And then after they vacated the property, it was put to many uses, and it was everything from the Illinois Institute of Technology for a while, Gallery Magazine headquarters, and eventually became a nightclub, first the Limelight and now the Excalibur. And I've done many a theme party there over the years. I did a lot with the Limelight. I worked with Excalibur. I've done ghost storytelling nights, psychic fairs. I did a Jack the Ripper Fest in 1988 for the 100th anniversary of Jack the Ripper. And I'll tell you, it's a very haunted spot. I had the run of the place. I could go over where I wanted. And the staff were both the Limelight and the Excalibur were very open with me. And a variety of different possibilities of things that happen there. For instance, one of the more common things is to hear your name called by a voice, and you go to check, there's nobody there, and the voice that calls your name is someone you know. So it's a mimicking ghost who can imitate somebody who's not there.
Wow.
And also in the storage room in the basement, people would hear boxes and crates moving around. They get a key and go inside, and it's the only key, the only entrance, and there'd be nobody in there. So who's moving the boxes and crates around seconds before, you know? Ghosts or rats on steroids would be the only explanation.
Now, Hap, you actually worked there, didn't you?
Yeah, we went in there and cleaned up after the electricians came in and rewired the whole building.
Right.
Okay.
And we were up on the second floor, and my partner, my nephew goes, come here. And I come and I look, and there's a lady down at the end of the hall.
There's a lady at the end of the hall.
And this is after hours, right?
I'm not a believer, you know, and I'm going, what's this? And he snaps a picture of her. And I snap a picture. She's got no feet.
What?
You still have those pictures?
Believe it or not, it's the God's truth.
You have the pictures?
You still have the pictures?
Download out of the camera, out of the cell phone. We tried.
You couldn't, wait, they wouldn't come out of your cell phone?
Didn't get it to come out of the cell phone. And then all of a sudden, the picture disappeared off her cell phone.
Wow.
Whoa.
Are you familiar with...
I mean, the lights were going on, the lights were going off, and it had just been rewired. And
right.
It's time to leave.
And you said a woman, you know, the most active spot that I know of is a woman's washroom down in the basement. Did you know about that?
Yes.
I was down there...
Noise down there in the basement, too, because we were the only two in the whole building.
I was there with... in fact, you've met... the two police officers I was there with that time, they were down here with me before on a previous show, and we were down there as part of a ghost hunting program when it was still the Limelight, and there would be a cold spot, the shape of a person, size of a person, you could feel it, that would come out of the wall, move around, go into the wall, come out somewhere else. And we actually were pursuing that for probably a good 20 minutes or more around the basement, where it would move away and you could find it again. And it's not cold water pipes or frozen ground, because it moves.
Well, was the woman that you photographed with your cell phone, was she wearing, like, period clothing, or did she look like she was, you know, a present day?
She looked like she was from the early 50s.
Really?
And what part of the second floor did that happen on?
All the way up toward the back.
Uh-huh.
And you and your nephew were the only people in that big
building.
You are a brave soul. I mean, just walking in there knowing I was one of two people would freak me out.
About what hour did that happen?
About 6 o'clock at night.
6 o'clock at night. But it was not open to the public. There's nobody else around.
No, it wasn't open to the public at all.
But even 6 o'clock at night, I'll tell you, I don't know about you, but when I see that building, it takes on different moods.
Yeah.
Because it's that that granite, it's mm-hmm. that black granite, that gray granite, and depending on how much sunlight hits it, depending on how much moisture there is, it can either be almost black, it can be charcoal gray, it can be a light gray, it can be a dried blood pinkish gray color
to
it.
Very ominous when we're going
as we're driving home in the morning before
right.
it when it's still dark.
It's always taking on a different coloration, yeah. different mood.
Yeah, well, we thought it. Got a lot of different moods, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, we can hear it in your voice, Hap. There's no doubt in my mind. As you said, you're not a believer, but you had the picture to prove it.
I've never been a believer in my lifetime. And we still got the camera, and we're still trying to figure out what's going on.
Wow.
Did you ever take it to a phone store to see if they could help you on that?
I think we're going to do that.
Yeah, you should try that.
Yeah. Well, if you ever get anything.
We showed it to three or four different people, and they saw it, and it's she ain't got no feet.
You hate when that happens. Wow. Well, if you are ever able to get anything off that cell phone, please let us be the second or third to know, right, Richard?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Oh,
yeah. Thank you for
that. Keep us in the loop. Thank you so much.
By the way, speaking of that, we should mention that tomorrow night we're going to have our friend Will Crockett from ShootSmarter.com. And he knows more than most people that we will ever talk to about photography and film and digital cameras, and we're going to talk a little bit about how to take pictures of ghosts and goblins and all kinds of things.
And we might even talk to the vampire that he photographed when he was down in New Orleans recently. It's a very eerie photo.
Interesting email, a two-part email. This comes from Kay, and she says, a funny one. I used to go out to the old Argonne National Lab. Always saw weird lights, etc. One night we were coming home from a party, and I had on a long pleated purple dress. I had a candle from the car, and we lit it and started walking down the path, just goofing around. Had the candle to my face, and all of a sudden we heard voices, and a group of teenagers came around one of the bends in the road and saw me and went nuts. We don't know where they ran, but they did not come back our way. So if you ever hear about a ghost in a long flowing purple gown, that's me.
That was her. It was Kay.
Then she says, on a serious note, I live in a house in Michigan that stands on Indian ground. For years, we've heard weird sounds, footsteps. Not just the family, but people who came over have heard them. The strangest was when my daughter was recovering from surgery. I was in the other bedroom, and I was startled awake, ran to her room, and there was a purple ball or something swirling around her. She woke up as I entered and said, I asked for you to come in my dream. Something was covering me. So I slept with her, and the next morning she was feeling much better.
Wow. I asked you to come to me in my dream. That's some pretty heavy stuff.
Yes. But Native American ghost lights are quite common. In fact, with the Cherokee, they're often used to find lost treasure. Mm-hmm. So where the light sits down, that's where you dig.
Mm-hmm.
You can never find the right spot. And a friend of mine, he was an anthropology student, and he was down in Mexico, and he was chasing, he said, a blue light the size of a Volkswagen. And he knew that if he could ever find where it landed, he'd have a big treasure. He could probably retire.
Hmm.
But it went on property owned by a retired American Army colonel, rumored to be nuts. So he knew he'd get killed for trespassing if he went there.
Wow.
So he couldn't follow it. But, yeah, Barney told me all about that spot. And it's big in the border area there, the Tex-Mex border area, and big with the southeastern tribes, these ghost lights leading to treasure.
And then there's the knocking sound. Mm-hmm. I was raised hearing the story from my grandmother that, you know, times were incredibly tough. Obviously, you know, this was before electricity and such, so you had the house lit by lanterns, and they were, you know, wondering where the next meal was going to come from, and yet there was this knock, knock, knocking on the wall, and finally, out of frustration and desperation, went right to where that knocking was on the wall and opened it up, and there was a mini little pot of coin.
Wow.
That was enough to allow them to survive just a wee bit longer. And then the knocking never occurred after the...
What a nice gesture from the spirit world.
Yeah,
yes.
The pot of coin was found there.
I want, Johnny, I want you to look over your shoulder into the other studio.
Oh, that's weird. The papers that are hanging
on
the wall.
What is causing that? Now, I'm not making this up.
They're standing
Richard,
away from the
look
wall.
Look over there.
You see the papers that are pinned to the wall? They're standing straight up and away from the wall.
Dan, is there some fan on over there, or what's...
Yes.
Oh, there is a fan on.
I was debating, but yes, there is a fan on.
Okay. From this angle, it's very creepy looking.
It is. There are three pieces of paper taped to the wall, and they're standing away from the wall, and they're blowing like there's a window open, and there isn't a window open.
There's no window in that room.
But there is, in fact, a fan blowing on it. That's... Thank you, Dan.
See, it would have been the beginning of a great legend.
I know.
I love the atmosphere.
You know, Colonel McCormick.
Well, we joke about hearing the ghost of Colonel McCormick in these dark halls at night, and then the ghost of Fannie Mae. I jokingly said that one time, and somebody said, "Oh, there's a ghost named Fannie Mae." I said, "No, there used to be the Fannie Mae candy store up front where the showcase studio is." And so the joke is, you smell chocolate, it's the ghost of Fannie Mae.
Yeah.
Or Blummer's chocolate.
We go back to the calls, and Janine, who's in Elmhurst. Hi, Janine. You're on WGN Radio with Chicago's ghost hunter, Richard Crowe.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I don't get to hear it too often, but tonight I'm up late.
Good.
Well, thank you.
My son was videotaping a wedding at the Woodstock Opera House.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Is he familiar with the ghost that's supposed to be there?
Elvira.
Mm-hmm.
Elvira?
Yes.
Because when the pastor was making the Bible reading about love never fails,
mm-hmm.
he made sure he plugged the camera in to make sure that he wouldn't run out of battery.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
The plug was pulled.
Oh, really? Because I've always heard she stays up in the balcony.
Yes,
well,
but you know she
videotaped.
And she committed suicide because her boyfriend jilted her. So how appropriate.
That she would get upset at a wedding.
Yes.
Richard, you want to give a little bit of the background of the ghost of the Woodstock Opera House?
Yeah, this was another one of these long-lived ghosts here who's been around forever. She's a ghost that never seems to get out of the productions here at the Woodstock Opera House. She was a woman who was in love with a young man, and he rather callously dropped her. He had another girl that he dropped her for. And she just committed suicide there. I'm trying to think, did she hang herself or jump from? I think she may have just jumped from a high floor.
Mm-hmm.
And but they even have a seat that's Elvira's seat that they pay attention to. Yes, up in the balcony. Yes,
because when he developed the pictures and everything, there's a picture of him in the balcony. I don't know if the photographer took it or what. And there's a big orb right behind him.
Wow.
Oh.
What was the seat?
Do you have my book handy, John?
I don't remember
off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, if you want to hang on, I'll be glad to take your number and give you a call about that, give you all the details
and
on
that. You'd love to see the orb, too.
And I'd love to see the orb photograph, too, yes.
Oh,
so what he was, the orb was caught on, not digital, but on a regular...
Right.
Right.
And he has it on his screensaver now.
Okay.
Does he really?
But it looks like a man, and it doesn't look too happy. He said, oh, my gosh, it's right behind me, and they don't look too happy.
Wow.
But it is an orb.
Uh-huh.
Because then I said, oh, it's probably a spot on the camera. He said, Mom, no.
He knew. He felt something when he was in the balcony.
Well, the fact that it happened right there at a well-known haunted spot, and it happened at the perfect timing here during a wedding. Yeah, if you want to hang on, I'll get your number, and I'll be glad to talk to you further about that.
Okay.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Can I have your number? For
Hang on for a second.
Hold on for a second, and our producer, Dan Shagrew, will get some information from you off the air.
Now, that's great, because we've talked about the Woodstock Opera House Ghost forever, and this guy goes in there not knowing.
Dick Tracy and Elvira, those are the two most famous personalities from Woodstock. Yes.
Yeah. And thanks to our show, the Woodstock High School Choir has been made famous. And those kids talk about performing at the... everybody knows if you go up there to perform. We have friends who come to town, Muriel Anderson.
Sure.
And she said she always looks up in the balcony to see if she can see Elvira getting situated for the concert. And, you know, kind of... You want to have a good rapport with her, because she can make or break you.
We've heard stories from all times. I mean, it can be Christmas. It doesn't matter if there's something going on up there.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've heard from numerous sources. I mean, people who wouldn't be calling just because, Richard Crowe, but people who know nothing about the ghost stories we've talked about.
And they feel the presence.
Something weird is going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Janine, I'm glad you called. Thank you.
I want to touch on an email that came in from Walt. And Walt says, I'm curious what Richard might know about hauntings in Dubuque, Iowa. I had a friend who had attended Loras College there. And Loras was known to have a number of ghosts. There are two ghosts in a Loras theater, which my friend had seen while working alone on a set late one night. I heard other stories from other people who had also been students there as well. One explanation of the activity at Loras is that one of the oldest campus buildings had been a war hospital during the Civil War. From what I was told, Dubuque in general has a rather high level of ghost activity, so I was curious as to what Richard may know about hauntings in Dubuque.
I'm afraid I don't have a lot to say about that, although I have heard something about Loras College. But I would just say that because of the proximity to the Mississippi River and to, once again, this water and motion connection, it wouldn't surprise me one bit that it's a very active spot.
I found a site on the internet, Walt, you might want to check this out. I did a search for Loras College haunting, and there's a storyteller's take on a priest who once told him of an experience related by his former professor. The priest who taught his religion class at Loras in Dubuque said, I was in my first parish. It was a peaceful setting at a big St. Bernard dog who slept under the front porch of the rectory. One night I heard Robo barking furiously, but I was tired from a long day of calling, and eventually I went back to sleep. The next night I heard Robo barking again about the same time of night, a little after midnight. I went to the window and I saw there were lights on over at the church. I hastily dressed and stepped outside and find out who could be there at such a time. Then I saw Robo with his hair up, pointing with his body toward the church. Something in his manner made me nervous. I was fearful now of disturbing an intruder. But when I arrived at the church, I saw a priest at the altar celebrating the Mass after midnight. He had his back to me, as a priest would at the time, so I could not see his face. I hesitated, but then I started down the center aisle. Who could it be? Parish pastors are very careful not to go into another man's parish without permission, and why past midnight? As I came closer to the strange priest, suddenly whirled and faced me, his robes flying outward, his eyes flashing fire. He held the flat of his hand at me and said, stay back, stay back. I still have five nights of masses to say. The face was strangely familiar to me, yet I knew him not. I backed away and I left the church at his command. For five more nights, Robo barked and I saw lights on in the church, but something held me from saying anything to anyone at first. At last, the nightly sessions were over. I talked with members of the parish committee. We looked into the historical records and found the photograph of a former pastor in our parish. The face was the man at the altar. A member of the parish committee said the priest took many contributions for masses to be said, but he was accidentally killed before he could fulfill his obligation. My friend heaved a sigh of relief and said, "We in the ministry take these commitments to say Masses very seriously." He had taken the small contributions, fully expecting to conduct the Masses he had promised. So he tries to do that. And that's kind of a theme that we hear, you know,
yes,
feeling that you had unfinished business.
Yes.
That's a great story.
In fact,
story.
I heard a similar story about Visitation Church growing up.
Mm-hmm. Really?
My parish, my old neighborhood, yes.
Mm-hmm. And people had actually seen a priest
They'd
there?
See a priest on the altar at night, some ungodly hour, and you'd go and talk to the regular priest there about that later, and they say, "Well, you have to sign in, you have to get permission to use an altar like that," and we didn't have anybody do that.
Wow. That's a good one.
Speaking of churches and ghost sightings, what was the story? You've told this before. It was a Chicago church with the shadowy figures.
Oh, St. Rita's Church.
Yeah, what was that
That's
story?
A good again? Story for now because it's a All Souls Day connection on that. It was on All Souls Day back in 1961 when I was at Visitation Grammar School, not that far away. 63rd and Fairfield is where St. Rita's Church is located. And there were people there that morning who were saying prayers for the souls of the dead, a tradition on All Souls Day to have them released from purgatory. And suddenly, the organ began to give off some wild screeches. So people in the organ, people on the ground floor, I should say, turned to look at the organ loft, thinking perhaps some teenagers up there messing around. And then they see nobody at the organ. It's playing by itself. But on either side of the organ were these misty figures, these monk-like figures are described as three in white on one side, three in black on the other. So that, of course, panics the crowd, and they head for the doors to get out. And these metal and glass doors, which worked fine previously, now these metal and glass doors wouldn't budge, and they're struggling to get out, and the figures are now on the ground floor, gliding close to the people. That's when a cold breeze blows the doors open, and as everybody runs out of the church, they hear a hoarse voice say, "Pray for me." Later, the pastor, who was Father McHale, tried to track down people who were there at the time and get them not to talk about it and ask them to keep it quiet, but it was too late. The story spread rapidly throughout the South Side, and I remember hearing about it very well. And that particular incident, I think, has a good moral lesson to it. I think that the soul of the person who was requesting the prayers, the pray for me, whether male or female, we don't know, just a hoarse voice, hopefully left with the good guys in white robes, not the bad guys in black. The dichotomy, the color symbolism is so obvious there. Mm-hmm. And it's never happened again, but to this day, people at St. Rita's Church, especially on All Souls Day, always look over their shoulder to see if there's anybody up in the organ loft when they enter that church.
Wow. Richard Crowe is our guest.
I have an odd question for you. In all the years that we've been doing these shows with you, I don't think I've ever asked this question. We hear stories like that connected with churches. It is relatively common to hear stories of ghostly apparitions surrounding churches. Are there any ghost stories involving synagogues or involving the Jewish faith? I'm sure there must be.
I just can't think of one at the moment, but I'll tell you one thing. With the Chinese, with their feng shui belief, and I know you've been studying that lately a lot, Johnny,
mm-hmm.
Here's an example from, it would work with the synagogue as well, but an example from Chinatown here on the south side of Chicago. Across the street from the St. Teresa Chinese Mission, the Catholic Church, there are three buildings that have bagua mirrors, these little round mirrors, facing the church. From a business and a couple apartments, and they face out. And this is a mirror used to chase away evil, chase away ghosts and werewolves and vampires and mm-hmm. any kind of evil. And some years ago, a priest at that church found out about that, and he's going, "Why are they insulting me here by mm-hmm. having these mirrors face the church?" Well, it's all in the eye of the beholder, I suppose, because what happened was a kindly Chinese person took the priest aside and said, "That's a compliment. The mirrors face the church because your church works. When people go to church, you know, you don't go to church unless something's bothering you, let's face it. You know, when things are going your way, you're having a good time. But when you go to church, oh, please, God, get me out of this predicament here, hear my prayers and all that, they don't want the evil that's now off your back that you just got rid of in that church, crossing the street, entering into their business, their home, or their apartment, whatever.
Oh.
So they've got the mirror saying, you know, evil head down the block, you know, keep moving. And so that would typically work in any kind of a house of worship where people come to try to get rid of their problems. Mm-hmm. And so the Chinese are you can see this. In fact, it's not only across from the church in Chinatown, but they also have mirrors across from schools, because they're just hotbeds of, you know, mm-hmm. hyperactivity, sex, drug, and rock and roll, I suppose. And they want no evil across the street from those locations either.
Keep it across the street. I love it.
Keep it moving. Keep it away. But across from a church, across from a house of worship of any kind, or across from a school, whatever.
Wow. Okay. Richard Crowe, we're going to give you a chance to talk with him, like Tyrone, who's in Rockford's on WGN. How are you, Tyrone?
Hi, Steve and Johnny.
Hi, Tyrone.
Second time I've talked to you guys.
Yes, sir.
First of all, Richard, before I ask you my original question, he's no longer with us anymore, but did you by any chance know the ghost hunter of St. Louis, David Hoy?
I met David Hoy. In fact, I did some radio with him some years ago, yes.
Okay, I thought that would have been, I would have liked to have had an audio of you and him together.
Mm-hmm.
I did David Hoy.
Was that St. Louis?
No, he was up here. He was up here. I'm trying to remember what the event was. It was many years ago. How long has he been gone now?
Oh, I want to say he probably passed away in the 80s.
Yeah, I believe so, because it was a long time. And I did some we had a panel discussion, and I remember that he and I were on the panel. I'm trying to remember who else. It may have been Evelyn Paglini, Dr. Evelyn Paglini, who's no longer in the area. But yeah, we did have a very interesting panel discussion on radio, and I'm drawing a blank on what station it was, but it was a number of years ago. Probably was when there was a some kind of a fair, some kind of event where we were all speakers or all participants when that happened.
Okay, Richard, I know you've been on Unsolved Mysteries a long time ago.
Yes, that was with the, in fact, the Resurrection Mary story.
Yeah,
yes.
Well, they had another ghost story on there that I always remembered, and it was about a railroad line that ran from St. Louis to Dallas, and it is haunted by the ghost of a former railroad worker. I guess he was... I can't remember if it was the railroad worker or if it was the railroad manager, but one of them had murdered the other one over money, and they fell down dead there alongside this track that ran from St. Louis to Dallas, and they mentioned the town, you know, in Missouri that this took place, but I want to say this happened like in the 19th century or the 1930s, but ever since this happened over money, the murder... This train track has been haunted ever since, and railroad conductors have seen the ghost alongside the track here, and various passengers and engineers in the trains. And do you recall the story or remember it?
Actually, I do not, but a lot of haunted railroad stories around this country. There's something about the railroad tracks, parallel lines like that, that seem to be very conducive for ghost stories.
And it doesn't necessarily have to mean that there was a train crash or anything
no,
like that.
No, no. In fact, there are many ghost light stories connected with rail lines. But I do know, I've been told about this, I didn't get a copy yet, but I understand that on Amazon.com you can look up the best ghost stories of Unsolved Mysteries on a DVD. And I know that the Resurrection Mary piece is on that, and it wouldn't surprise me if they did this. That sounds like it would be a very good story to have on there as well, so it might be on there. You might want to check into that.
And that's available from Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, any major distributor of DVDs like that, check that out. It's probably there, but I'm not familiar with that, but now you've got my interest up. I'm going to have to look into that.
And we were talking off the air, too, about this area just south of St. Louis where there's a small town that on the 4th of July, the people come out and just huge numbers and just sit along the Mississippi River there and just wait for what they think will be a funeral procession.
Mm-hmm.
That the ghostly sightings of what appeared to be a funeral procession going back to the last turn of the century. And, you know, the people just wait patiently for hours on end.
Well, not only would that fit in with our Running Water Association that we've been talking about, but also that would be the New Madrid earthquake fault area down there as
sure.
well.
Yeah, interesting. Tyrone?
Earthquake faults are often connected with ghostly activity, too.
And, of course, that would be here in Illinois. Tyrone, thanks for your call. We're going to continue with Richard Crowe here on News Talk 720 WGN. clarification on the story of the Woodstock Opera House ghost named Elvira. Her seat is DD113. And there's activity has been reported from the row 113, where her seat would be found. Seat goes up, seat goes down. She was actually a performer, a ballerina, who did not get a part in a production. So she threw herself to her death. And for that reason, we're hearing from actors who say they've worked the house before. And if you miss your cue, she's heard to sigh in disgust. Oh, you people, you know.
What would that feel like, getting critiqued by a ghost? It's one thing to be haunted, but getting critiqued.
Getting critiqued, right. And Shelley Berman, a listener sent me to a site where Shelley Berman reported that he was performing there, doing his stand-up back in the 50s, and actually reported that there was activity in what appeared to be the row where her seat was. We don't know if she liked the production or disliked the production. Also, Richard, Brandon wants to know if you have any information on that goofy device they use on television when the ghost hunters are looking for ghosts in rooms. It has a single indicator light, and they ask the spirit to pass their hand over it. Is that the show where the faces are all green and their eyes are glowing?
I think it is, yeah.
Is that a EMF detector? I'm not sure, yeah.
Because Richard doesn't use that kind of stuff. You just go out there.
Well, you just kind of go and look.
Actually, yeah, I approach it more as a journalist, just having various people describe to me their incidents and chronicle that. But I do have friends who do deal with that when need be. But the problem with all that equipment is that when you try to do it in an urban situation, you've got so many extraneous feed over bleeding from different kinds of hidden wires and cell phone towers and everything else that just knock everything out.
And there was a time when we used to talk about using old Polaroid cameras to capture something. If you were going to capture a ghost, it was going to be a
Polaroid. The SX-70 color Polaroid film was the best back then, yeah.
But nowadays, people are reporting that they're capturing things on digital camera, but then you always wonder, is it Photoshopped?
No, it's not that. What you have to worry about with the digital, I'm afraid, is dust particles. You stomp your feet in a dusty place and the little orbs show up everywhere because you've just got particles of dust, or it could be you blow your nose and you got orbs, and you've got mist from the atmospheric conditions. Oh, absolutely.
Oh.
You've got to be extremely careful with that kind of material because you don't know where they. So what you really have to have is like you know, another person with another digital camera photographing from a slightly different angle, so you can get the feedback and get two people to get it at the same time to know for sure.
That's wild.
I've never heard that question before. Is that a ghost or did you blow your nose?
It's the first question a good ghost hunter asks. Did anybody blow their nose or sneeze before this picture was taken?
Resurrection Mary. That is the story that everybody wants to make sure that they understand. And every year when we have Chicago's ghost hunter on the show with us, Richard Crow, he has to tell the story of Resurrection Mary. This really is... it is the most popular, it is the most famous of the Chicago area ghost stories.
Absolutely, yes.
Now, other communities around the world have their own version of a hitchhiking ghost.
There have been hitchhiking ghost stories going back in time before the automobile. in fact,
jumping on carriages.
Right. There was a horse and wagon story from Ireland about a woman named Petticoats Loose, because she would, when women wore a number of petticoats, she would like take off all of the extra petticoats so she could kick higher and dance freer here when she got to the dance, and she would hitch for rides in wagons in County Tipperary. So you find these stories all around. However, there's none that can hold a candle to Resurrection Mary for both frequency of appearances and for good accounts from people, because this is not just urban myth or legend, because I've talked to numerous people who've had these experiences with this hitchhiking ghost firsthand.
Now, where would we find Resurrection Mary?
Well, if you want to find Resurrection Mary, you know, it's so funny, because I laughed with my bus driver, Gaston. I said, look, the police are out here guarding Resurrection Cemetery heavy right now. I said, but anybody should realize you're not going to sneak into the cemetery to find Resurrection Mary, because she's out of the cemetery. She's out somewhere at a dance or party having a good time. But traditionally, it's up and down Archer Avenue from Harlem Avenue, the city boundary at that point, all the way down into Justice, Illinois, for Resurrection Cemetery, and points further south, like the site of the Willowbrook Ballroom in Willow Springs, mm-hmm. and up and down that roadway in particular is where she's been encountered. Many, I'll just give you a couple examples, many accounts over the years. The deacon from the Greek church, Holy Cross, that you find out there in Justice, right across the street from the complex we call the Resurrection Triangle, this deacon in 1980 on a Sunday night, and a full moon hung in the sky, after the last service, he's driving home, and he's driving out Archer, and he gets to the front gates of the cemetery, and that's when he spots Resurrection Mary. So he hits the brakes, he stops, and she disappears. Well, he does a U-turn. He winds up at a nearby bar, Chet's Melody Lounge, the only bar open for miles along that stretch of roadway, and there he pounds down a few. And he's later interviewed by a reporter from the Valley Times, publisher nearby Lyons, the late Denny Johnson, a very dear friend of mine. And Denny calls me up, and he tells me about this. And Denny not only wrote it up for the Valley Times, but then it went to USA Today went international. Mm-hmm. Now, that deacon went to his superiors in the Greek church, requested a new assignment because he didn't want to be in Chicago any longer, so fearful. So he goes to Denver and then to Dallas. But as far as I know, he's not been back since. Too much for him. He wants to stay completely out of the entire area, let alone out of the area around Justice where Resurrection Mary haunts.
Okay, let's take everybody back. The story of Resurrection Mary.
Right. Maybe we should do the legend here to get everybody grounded here mm-hmm. on what most of the Chicagoland area has known now for years. If you've grown up around Chicago, especially South Side, since the 1930s, you would have been acquainted with a story told grammar school, high school, whatever, parties, whenever conversation would drift towards the supernatural, about a beautiful blonde Polish-American girl on the Southwest Side. And back in the 1930s, back in the days of the big band sound, the big band music, she loved going to dances and parties as many nights per week as she could get out of the house. So 3, 4, 5 times per week she'd be out at some club hall party to dance the night away. And that lifestyle, getting out so often, eventually cost her life. One night she's coming back from a party and she dies in a car accident. And her family arranges to have her body taken to a Southside funeral home. And there she's prepared for burial, put out in her dancing dress, dressed up in her dancing dress with her dancing slippers on her feet. So she's buried a few days later at the family plot, Resurrection Cemetery, south-southwest of Chicago in suburban Justice, Roman Catholic, primarily Polish-American, laid to rest. That would have been the end of the story, but she comes back like a ghostly Cinderella, back to the clubs, the halls, the places she went to when she was alive, only now she's out there in borrowed time. See, she's out there on the dance floor, but when the dancing stops, it's time for her to go home. And tonight, at this point now, today her home is Resurrection Cemetery. So she'll get a ride down Archer Avenue, and as they're proceeding along past the cemetery, she's got a young man who's just giving her a lift and thinks he's met the girl of his dreams. She'll either disappear in the front seat next to him, there 1 second, gone the next, or sometimes she will ask to be let out of the car. She says, "I must leave you now," and she'll run up to the cemetery fence and then melt away. But no matter what method she chose to disappear abruptly or with that extra flourish there, when she does this, that young man knows the girl of his dreams is gone forever and she's a ghost. And that's when the realization just settles in that he had a close encounter with Resurrection Mary.
Now, truck drivers have reported that they've picked her up. She's been sighted outside of pubs and restaurants along Archer Avenue.
I will never forget one night you were on the radio with us years ago, and we had some calls from police officers out in that area. Remember that night?
It was a rainy night, and we had... The police out there are well aware of this. It's Justice, Illinois, has the... Usually, they're the ones out there along Resurrection Cemetery, but there are other jurisdictions as well that might touch upon it. And... Resurrection Mary sightings in the area, she could be seen down as far as the Willowbrook Ballroom, mm-hmm. and that was a famous case in January of 1979, and that's when a cab driver from O'Hare had picked up a fare at Flavin Road in Archer, which is a bus stop with a World War II memorial and a CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps worker statue now. Those in the area know the landmarks I'm talking about. And he picks this woman up at the intersection on a wintry night, and he says, "Lady, I'm lost." He had picked up a fare at O'Hare, dropped the fare in Payless, didn't know where he was out there on the south side. He's driving up along Archer. He says, "Lady, get in the back seat. I'll give you a ride wherever you want to go. Just direct me back to the north side."
Hmm.
So she gets in the back seat, and 2 minutes up the road, I've timed it, 2 minutes up the road, she says, "This is the place." And he turns to ask her what she's talking about, and she's no longer in the back seat. Just as they're passing by Resurrection Cemetery on the right and the bunch of closed stores on the left, and he's so shook up, he takes the next day off work. So he's staying at home. He calls up the ballroom. He calls up the local police. And he winds up talking to newspapers. And he gets a sympathetic ear when he talks to Bill Geist from the Suburban Trib in Hinsdale. Bill Geist would also interview me on this particular case, and he met with Ralph the cab driver. And Bill Geist told me, "I don't believe in ghosts, but after I met Ralph the cab driver, I now believe in Resurrection Mary." And he did two long columns. He wound up in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. In fact, he does TV now, too. Mm-hmm. He's been some major TV.
CBS Sunday Morning.
And he's just, he can trace his phenomenal success here to that those two columns he did about Resurrection Mary. And, of course, what's so appropriate is that Bill Geist's last name in German is Bill Ghost, and he broke that story.
That's right.
Now, you had an incident where, in fact, there is some photographs in your book where you went to the cemetery and there was, you want to tell the story about the gates? And
Now, we've been talking about what you could call anecdotal material about people who claim they've seen her, danced with her, and all that. And that's all well and good, but you know it's based on the credibility of the witness. But when it comes to physical evidence, that was actually discovered one night back in August of 1976. It was back in 76 on a Tuesday night, in fact, on August the 10th, that a police sergeant from the Justice PD was in a squad car driving about. It was a one-man squad was the routine back then. And his dispatcher comes on the radio, tells him to proceed to the front gate, that there's a blonde in a white dress locked inside. He goes out to check, not because he thinks anybody's really going to be there, but because he's a good cop. It's a slow night. He drives out there, gets out of the car, shines a flashlight back and forth. He sees nobody inside. He's about to turn and leave. And then his attention is grabbed by two bars on the left-hand side gate. The bars are bent apart. There are handprints squeezed into the bronze. And on the green patina, the bronze bars are scorch marks, where handprints, fingerprints, palm prints are burned, impressed, squeezed onto the metal. And this is 1/16 of an inch thick bronze. Can't bend it with human strength, but there it was. And although he thought maybe it was an expensive hoax or prank, he realized that even if you were to try to fake it with heavy equipment, you'd be in plain sight of Archer, 150 feet or so away, mm-hmm. and you'd have constant flow of traffic observing you, and there's no way it could be pulled off. But the only explanation that makes any sense is that something supernatural happened. The ghost actually bent these bars. Well, after that occurred, the story spread throughout the area, and I heard about it through friends of a fireman who was there in Justice, tracked down the sergeant, interviewed him, photographed him, and I watched to see what would happen next. The cemetery's getting all perturbed. I knew that. I wrote to the Catholic Cemetery Board in the spring of 1977 and offered to buy those bars. The cemetery wouldn't sell, and then they blowtorched them. Blowtorching burned them black, but still, they were highly visible, in fact, more so now. People came in larger numbers, and then by October of 77, with Halloween rapidly approaching, the cemetery saws the bars out. They were sent away to a mill to be straightened out. They were gone for over 1 year. They finally came back home again in late December of 1978. So the original bars are back, but they're welded back into place. They're straightened. The handprints are obliterated, and they've been painted. They went from black to green to a tacky gold, which is the color they are now, all in an attempt to cover up and destroy, to persuade people nothing happened. But as you know, it's in my book, I've got a photograph of the front gate. I've got all the photographs and the all the videotape in my DVD. And for those who've seen it, those who were out there and actually wrapped their hands around the bars and felt it, they know that something very special happened out there back in 1976.
So if you're driving along Archer Avenue and you see a blonde who, probably not wearing a coat, even though it's a very cool October night, If she stops and you catch a glimpse of her and the headlights don't feel compelled, unless you're game, don't feel compelled to pull over to the side of the road.
Well, remember, don't break for ghosts is my motto.
Yeah.
We do break for ghosts.
But don't break for ghosts unless you're a ghost hunter.
Don't break for ghosts unless you're able to take it, yes.
That's right.
And again, if you want to see these pictures, you can get Richard's book, a blatant plug for your book and your DVD, Richard.
Thank you, Steve. Yes, indeed. The book, the DVD, information about that on my website, ghosttours.com. You can only get the DVD through me right now,
mm-hmm.
But the book, of course, is available through bookstores all around. But do check with the website, though. Just ground yourself in all the information here, what is available here on this topic and many others, of course.
And the book is entitled Chicago Street Guide to the Supernatural, A Guide to Haunted and Legendary Places in and Near the Windy City. And it is readily available, as we said. We just saw it at a local Borders bookstore. And if it's not there, go out in a huff and go to a self-respecting bookstore.
No, the point is that they often sell out. They have to be restocked.
Yeah.
So
that's right.
You can't blame the bookstore.
That's true. You're right.
I want the bookstores on my side. Right.
But one of the many fascinating things to me about the story of Resurrection Mary is, as you say, with a lot of these things, they're legend, and you say, oh, yeah, there's one or two people. With Resurrection Mary, there is so much anecdotal evidence from so many divergent sources that led to the credibility.
And the speaking of credibility, the very credible nature of police officers and such.
Right. Well, you know the National Enquirer criteria, right? They will publish a story if it's backed up by a police officer, by an elected political figure, or by a member of the cloth. So I don't know about those elected political figures, but or I think a ranking military personnel too.
I think they.
But they want that's the kind of kind of background they want.
So when
for
they
the
say
witness.
Sources, then you know it's one of those.
But seriously, I mean, I know people. In fact, you guys remember the Cliff Leindecker used to be up here in Chicago?
Sure.
From the old National Tatler days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But he's a great character. He's based in Florida now. But.
On that note, we need to let Richard disappear into the vapor once again.
Right.
As we said, he never walks into the studio. He just sort of appears. Richard, it is always a pleasure to have you in the studio.